This is Ask a Biologist, a program about the living world, and I'm Dr. Biology. Today we'll explore the world of zombies. Now I know you're probably picturing mindless human corpses walking the earth in search of human flesh, but we know that zombies are not real, right? Well, at least human zombies are not real. But if you dig a bit deeper into the zombie world, it turns out they are real, at least for some animals like ants. My guest today is David Hughes, an entomologist and professor at Penn State University, who's been studying a pretty nasty fungus that can turn ants into zombies. Once the fungus infects an ant, it changes its behavior that leads to the death grip that I, for one, want to learn more about. Besides the work that David's doing with zombie ants, he has another project that I think everyone will want to learn about, and that's called Plant Village. Welcome to the show, David Hughes, and thank you for visiting with me today.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Before we jump into the story of zombies, ants, and death grips, let's talk a bit about fungus. Because fungus is neither a plant nor an animal. It actually has its own kingdom, fungi, which, you know, some people will know that it has yeasts and molds, and a lot of people have seen the common mushroom around. So what exactly is a fungus?
Well, you're right in starting off by talking about plants. Oftentimes people think they are plants. Fungi are actually more closely related to animals. They're a separate kingdom. So we have kingdom animals, kingdom fungi, and kingdom plants. And they are microorganisms, small cells that divide. Although when you see a mushroom, you notice that it's quite large. And they have a very unusual way of growing. Unlike plants, they don't photosynthesize or produce their own food, so they're not what we call autotrophs. They require consuming another source of material for carbon and protein. They have something called, and this is a big word, an osmotrophic life cycle. What they do is they literally pump out juices from their cells, which are often called hyphae. They pump these juices out into the environment, and those juices degrade parts of the environment, and then the fungi suck it back up. So it's a little bit like flies vomiting on a food source and then sucking that back up, or the contents of your stomach going onto your lunch and then you sucking that back up. This is called osmotrophic life cycles. And the benefit of this is that fungi have become really adept at colonizing a range of habitats. Many of them are pathogens of plants, so they live inside plant material. They're also pathogens of decaying material. So as a forest drops or a tree falls down, the fungi will colonize that. And that's where you see the mushrooms coming from. Many of them, like the zombie ant fungi, are actual pathogens of insects or other arthropods. So they get inside the body and consume it. And then we have fungi everywhere else on the planet. So people have recorded fungi at the bottom of the Marianas Trench, thousands of feet below sea level. They're in the tops of mountains. Fungi are everywhere, operating in spaces we don't typically see or think about.
So that we don't ever give the impression that all fungi are actually bad, they're really important. One of their roles is recycling.
Yeah. So were it not for the fungi breaking down the forests, we would be knee-high in trees or even higher. Fungi do a remarkably good job in decomposing material, releasing a lot of the material back into the environment. They also play a remarkably important role in allowing plants to colonize environments. It's something called ectomycorrhizal fungi that live on the roots of plants. They have a symbiotic, a mutualistic partnership between the plant and the fungus. The fungus has a place to live, and in return, it allows the plant to access nitrogen that it couldn't normally access.
David, you used two really great words there, symbiotic and mutualistic. And this is where two organisms working together benefit from each other. With the fungus we're going to talk about, we're talking about a parasite. And that's a one-way relationship where the parasite benefits and the host usually ends up dead. So would you tell us about the fungus that's taking control of the ants and turning them into zombies?
So this is a group called Ophiocordyceps, and it's a whole genus within a family. So it's a family of fungal species which are specialized to live inside insects, and they infect about 9 different groups or orders of insects. So caterpillars, butterflies, and hymenopterans, so that's the wasps and the bees and ants and so on. So very many insects are infected by this group. in the ants, what we see played out is the ability of these fungal species to control the behavior. So as the ants are out in the environment foraging for food, they pass through a patch of spores. These spores attach to the skin or the cuticle of the ant, and then they burrow through the cuticle over a number of hours, by which time the ant is back home inside the nest. And over 2 or 3 weeks, these fungal cells replicate slowly inside the body of the ant, and then they're ready to go on to the next stage of development. And that next stage is on the underside of a leaf, outside of the ant colony. So in order to get there, the fungi produce chemicals, alkaloids, neuromodulators. We originally derived the drug LSD, lysergic acid, from this group of fungi back in the 1930s. They also produce things like ketamine, which is a tranquilizer used in the veterinary industry for horses. So these fungi can produce chemicals that affect behavior. That's what they do with the ants. The ants leave the colony and they go onto the underside of a leaf and they bite firmly into a leaf, and that's where they die.
Ah, the death grip.
Uh-huh. And so the fungus needs a platform from which to grow, because what happens next when the ant is dead, attached to the leaf, is the fungus quickly converts all the muscle and tissue in the ant's body into fungal material, into hyphae, into long-term storage material, and then it grows out of the back of the ant's head. It explodes through the ant's head, the intersegmental membrane, as it's called, and then it produces a stalk from which spores are produced, and the cycle continues.
Right. You know, this is something that a good horror movie is made from, right?
Absolutely.
Is this fungus particular, or will it turn any ant into a zombie?
They seem to be highly specific based upon our research. We find that it's one ant, one fungus seems to be the rule. We find many hundreds of species are out there, and it's going to take many years to describe all of those. But we do find it's highly specific. And that makes a lot of sense because, after all, it's producing chemicals that can affect the behavior, and that would suggest specialization.
Is there a way for the ants to avoid or defend against the fungus?
Ants are remarkably good at defending themselves. They have great societies which rely upon what's called a social immune system, where individuals actually patrol the colony looking for disease and reducing that. So they're remarkably good at that. They probably use behavior as a major mode to avoid. For example, in the forest, we'll have patches of spores from this fungus, and these are infectious, so the ants can move around it. It's not just ants. Many insects are able to recognize the presence of fungal spores and avoid those. Now the job is upon the fungus to evolve a counter-strategy, and so we see these co-evolutionary arms races between the two.
We're talking about this fungus as a parasite, so it's a one-way relationship, and obviously that's not good for the ant. Are there other cases of parasitism, that's another word, changing animal behavior?
Lots of examples, and we're realizing this now. There's examples of this whole group of parasites called tawny-headed worms, and pretty much every species in the whole group is manipulating the behavior of crustaceans in water bodies. They make these crustaceans move up to the top of the water, where a bird can more easily pick them off, and that's how the parasite transmits from one host to another. That's called trophic transmission. There's another system, which is parasitic insects, wasps, which manipulate the behavior of spiders to build special cocoons, which are useful for the development of the wasp afterwards. There are examples of crickets being manipulated by worms called hairworms to jump into bodies of water because the worm needs to reproduce as an adult in the water. So it makes this terrestrial insect jump into the water, effectively committing suicide. And then for mammals, because it's not just a story about insects, we mammals, we're infected by something called Toxoplasma gondii, which is a small single-celled parasite which is similar to the group from where we see malarial parasites, Apicomplexan. In this case, it gets inside a rat and it controls the behavior of rats, making them lose their normal fear responses to cats. Because the parasite needs to go from one host, a rat, into the second host, a cat. And the best way to do this is to make the changes in the brain of the rat losing its fear. And in a number of studies, people have shown that these rats actually approach a cat, and then the cat eats the rat, because inside the rat, the cat's stomach is where these parasites need to reproduce. And so it's overcome that rather big challenge of causing a rodent to lose its innate fear. It does this by changing the gene expression in the brain, in the important center called the amygdala of the brain. So wonderful neuroengineering is happening all over the animal kingdom by parasites that have evolved to use their hosts as vehicles to get around the world from one point to another.
Right, and you're actually talking about a single cell.
Absolutely. That's
the part that blows me away on this. I started the show about zombies and that human zombies are not real. But could there be a fungus that could control humans?
So not control to get from point A to point B, but affect the behavior for sure. So there's a lot of really good historical evidence that the Salem witch trials in Massachusetts in the 1600s were caused by people eating rye, which contained fungal material inside it, called ergot. And historically in Europe, for hundreds of years, we've had something called St. Anthony's Fire, where you've had mass hallucinations. And remember, LSD has come from this group of fungi and in fact came from ergot of rye. And so there's a lot of convincing evidence that we'll see these. And the last mass hallucination event was in France in 1952, where the whole town went literally berserk because they consumed vast amounts of alkaloids, which are similar to LSD. So in that way, they can affect their behavior. The role that fungi play in human diseases is underappreciated. There's something called valley fever out in the West, where this fungal material is coming up from the soil. It's getting into people's nervous systems and is slowly crawling throughout their nervous system, reproducing. It's not beneficial. It's not helping the fungus transmit from point A to point B, but it is nonetheless affecting our behavior. So there are examples of fungi, and then more broadly, of course, other parasites like viruses, like rabies, certainly do control human behavior.
So the zombie ants that we've been talking about, do you find them everywhere? Or are they specific to particular regions?
It used to be that we thought they were just in the tropical belt around the world. But in our studies, we've worked all over the planet. I've worked in 11 countries on 5 continents. And we find them throughout the tropical belt, of course, so Africa, Asia, South America. But we find them in the U.S. So we have a big population in South Carolina that we found through the collaboration of a citizen scientist, Kim Fleming, who was a great natural historian and has been working with us now for 4 or 5 years and actually is a co-author on our scientific publications. And I'm really happy to say we're actually going to name a new species of zombie ant fungus after her. So it's going to be called Ophiocordyceps Kim Fleming's eye, which is really great. So it occurs in the south of the U.S., but right up into the Canadian border, there are records of this. So there could be zombie ants in your backyard. So please go out and look. And actually, sometimes people email me, or well, relatively often, and tell me they found one. And they'll send me some samples, which is really nice.
Well, it's interesting because one of your publications is in a journal called PLOS, the Public Library of Science. And I found it intriguing because we wanted to sit down with you and talk about this. And we'll actually have a companion story about this on what we call Plausible. Why I find it intriguing is this is not uncommon for the citizen scientist to play a big role in research. And in this particular case, you wouldn't have found this ant without Kim.
No, not at all. So I was at Harvard looking at the collections there in what's called the Harlow Herbarium. And from a very notable scientist called Taxter, who's long since dead. And we looked into this collection of samples. And over the last 140 years, there were simply 49 samples. It was missed by the entire mycological community, those people who study fungi, and the entire myrmecological community, all the people who study ants. It just wasn't on anybody's radar. And I sort of understood from that it doesn't exist in the US. It's not present. But it was really Kim. It was really that citizen science, that naturalist flair that she has, that was able to see that and then say, oh, it's very common here. And literally 4 days after hearing that, I was down in South Carolina working with her. And thankfully, we haven't stopped since.
We talked about this pretty nasty, at least for the ants, fungus. But it turns out when I was doing some research, this fungus actually has its own parasite.
Yes. So you would think this is a terrible situation for the ants, but nature is complex, and especially nature in rainforests. And so there's always something out there looking for a lunch. And in this case, there's something called a hyperparasitic fungi. In fact, there's many of them. There's tens and tens of species. And these have evolved to be specialists on the fungus, which is controlling the behavior of the ant. work we haven't published, but I'll share here, is that we see also flies which have evolved, gall midge flies, that have evolved to consume this fungus. And there's even a parasitoid wasp of the fly, of the fungus, of the ant on the leaf. Wow. So rainforests are wonderfully complex places to see these great theaters of coevolution being played out.
There are people that will find this fascinating just for the basic research. Obviously, zombies, just in that a title, these days, it's great. But there's more to this research than understanding just the interaction of the fungus with the ants. It goes into what we would call applied, or for humans, we always are trying to think about, well, what's it going to do for us? Mm. And it turns out that you have some really interesting links with your research in a couple areas.
Yeah, so if you spend a number of years working on parasites that have evolved to get in and out of the insect nest, that sort of tells you ways in which we might be able to ourselves get chemicals in and out of those nests to perhaps destabilize them. We all worry about colony collapse disorder, and rightfully so. But in many social insect species, we'd be really happy if they did collapse, like the fire ant in the southern U.S., which costs an annual cost of $6 billion in all the damage it does. If we can get something into the colony center that kills the queen, this would be really effective, especially because that little pest is now going into China and Australia, and it's a really difficult thing to control. So we can learn lessons from these coevolutionary dances between parasites and their hosts. The fungus I work on, Ophiocordyceps, has long been used in the medical arena. It has been used in China for the last 1,500 years. From a species which infects caterpillars in the High Tibetan Alps. It has demonstrated antimicrobial, so it kills bacteria and stuff, and anti-TB and anti-malarial properties. So it's a really good therapeutic. But you have to go to the top of the world to get it, to Tibet. In South Carolina, it's a dime a dozen. It's the same, more or less the same species. So there's lots of untapped potential in controlling injurious diseases of humans like cancer. Remember, of course, that the whole basis of our antibiotic industry is fungal species like penicillin, and we need them, and we need more of them. So the more searching, the better.
David, I want to ask you about another project you have going. It's very intriguing. It's called Plant Village. It's a nice cross of science, citizen science, and social networking. Can you give me a short rundown on Plant Village?
So I've traveled around the world and worked in rainforests. And every time you come out of a rainforest, you come into a farm. And these are poor farmers who are subsisting and growing crops at a marginal value. And a lot of the crops are being hammered by infectious diseases. I had a good fortune to be traveling with a guy called Dr. Harry Evans from England and a world expert on plant diseases. And every time I came out of a forest, I walked into a farm and I got this master class in plant pathology, or how diseases are transmitted. And I realized, as a society in the UK, in the US, or anywhere else on the planet, we're not training people like him. And we should, but we're not. But still, the farmers are losing 40 to 60% on average of their annual production each year in these developing countries. And so we need to do a better job. And everywhere in the world you go, you see phones, and all farmers have phones. So what we did, very simply, myself and my colleague, who's really excellent in this space, called Dr. Marcel Salaté at Penn State, what we did was made all the world's content on growing food freely and openly accessible to anybody in the world with a phone. So we just gave away a library of information. But we also wrote it with the farmer in mind. And Lindsay McMenemy is a plant scientist on the project, and she just really is good at writing content. So now it's the largest social network around food plants in the world. Almost a million people have come to the site, and we're going further. We're going to leverage the power of the phone and your camera to automatically diagnose the diseases. So a farmer either in Ghana or Georgia can point her phone at a plant and get an automatic diagnosis. And what we want to do is nothing less than fundamentally transform the way agriculture is done and the way diseases are diagnosed by using the hundreds of millions, if not billions, of farmers around the world who have these phones in their pockets, which, remember, have more than a million times the processing capability than the computers to send the man to the moon.
So on Ask a Biologist, all my guests get three questions. I suspect a couple of them will be somewhat familiar. So here we go. Let's go with the three questions. When did you first know you wanted to be an entomologist?
I sort of describe myself as a biologist, and I knew right from the get-go, right from 4 years old, I greatly enjoyed David Attenborough. I grew up in Ireland, and it was a big thing on BBC TV, and every Sunday I would really devour these programs that came through the TV, and I was lucky in that regard. I guess I was unlucky in that I didn't have a lot of opportunities. I got kicked out of school at the age of 15, and I came from a poor environment in Dublin, and nobody in my family had ever finished high school, and so 4 or 5 years of going around and doing relatively dead-end jobs, horse farms, cycle courier, building site. But I'd always wanted to be a biologist. So I got back into university and I took the chance and I was able to become a professional biologist. So I was lucky in the regard that I knew I wanted to be a biologist, but unlucky in that I was a poor kid with not many opportunities.
Was there a mentor, someone that actually turned the...
No, it was brute force and ignorance, I would say. I lived in the inner city in Dublin. I would climb into abandoned buildings looking for bird nests. I would try to go out to the countryside as much as possible. I kept a veritable menagerie of animals in my house, from snakes to gerbils and everything else in between. I just loved animals. I always did. And I just kept going until, thankfully, I got to where I am today.
Okay, we know how you got here, which actually is a little more challenging than some of our biologists have been here. So I'm going to take it all away from you. Okay. You can't be an entomologist / biologist. What would you be? What would you do if you could pick any other career?
I like the life of the mind. I think one of the greatest things we can do in our society is think about ideas. So it wouldn't be a great challenge for me to think about doing history or arts or the humanities. Are you telling me that I can't be at a university? Do I have to go? If that was the case, then I would open a bookshop. I wouldn't aim for money. I have very little interest in it. I would just enjoy the opportunity to surround myself with books, which I've always done. I love books deeply. So a librarian, bookshop keeper, some sort of explorer of ideas. You know, we have such a short life of 70 to 100 years and such a store of knowledge to find. So I would engage myself if I couldn't do this. That would be not a great challenge.
The last question is, what advice would you have for a young entomologist, again, or biologist, or perhaps someone who doesn't like their job and wants to shift to another career? They've always thought they would be a biologist. And with your particular focus, I think you might have some great insights for those students out there that don't think they have a chance.
If you don't think you have a chance, understand you are completely and utterly wrong. There are lots of chances. So find a book, find a web series, find some information, and just consume it. Consume it for the pure joy of consuming it. And that's the great scientists throughout the ages, from Galileo to Darwin and the contemporaries today. People who just want to discover things. So go and, you know, engage with all the great content on the web, some great information. If you can't get into a community college or stay in school or find somebody who can kind of push you, please do that. But stuff like Ask a Biologist is great because the web really opens up these communities. But if you realize you're doing it for its own sake, that's the very best. Be curiosity driven and find out the information. And that, even if you stay in the job that you have or the conditions that you have, that will enrich your life immeasurably. And then you'll never be satisfied. You'll always want more. You'll always go on. And that's the true mark of a scientist or a curiosity driven mind, to constantly go on. At the end of the great story of your life, you will be happy having done that and you will have learned a lot more.
We get a lot of questions from students that say they want to be a biologist, but they have this hang up. They say, but I'm not good at math. Do I have to know math? How did you do in math?
I was terrible. And as I was kicked out of school, I mean, I have a terrible, terrible education. I mean, I went to Oxford and Harvard and Copenhagen and all the fine fancy pants places around the world. But in terms of the basic, in terms of English writing and math, I don't think that's a barrier. I think what's important is a passion for a topic. And that can be any topic. It can be the history of the Civil War. It can be biology. It can be anything in between. And then you have to have grit and determination to put away the distractions of life, like the phone and the alerts, and just to open a book or to look at the great content on the web. And just sit down and say, what is this person saying to me? And how can I understand this? So put in the hard work with the passion and you will go far. I don't do mathematical biology myself, but I collaborate extensively with people. And if you can bring to the table this understanding of biology, you will find collaborators. That's the beauty of science, because it's a collaborative exercise, and you can find really good, fruitful exercises at the boundary.
David Hughes, thank you very much for visiting with me today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to Ask a Biologist, and my guest has been David Hughes, an entomologist and professor at Penn State University. For those of you who would like to explore more about zombie ants, you might like to visit the companion PLOSSIBLE article on Ask a Biologist. The address is askabiologist.asu.edu/zombie-ants. And don't worry if you couldn't write that down. We'll have it on the page that also hosts this podcast. And those of you that would like to learn more about Plant Village, that's an easy one. It's plantvillage.com, and you can check out all the things that David's been doing with that project. The Ask a Biologist podcast is produced on the campus of Arizona State University and is recorded in the Grassroots Studio, housed in the School of Life Sciences, which is an academic unit of the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences. And remember, even though our program is not broadcast live, you can still send us your questions about biology using our companion website. The address is askabiologist.asu.edu, or you can just Google the words Ask a Biologist. I'm Dr. Biology.